This is a Triple J podcast.
Hey, you're listening to Science with Dr. Carl on Triple J. Sam Lane here with you. I was filling in for Lucy this week, and it was a banger. We covered a lot of things, from helping someone whose friend doesn't believe in gravity to talking to a professional motocross racer. This episode had it all. Dr. Carl, hello.
Good morning. How are you? It's lovely to be working with you again, Dr. Sam.
Yes, we're back. We're ready. I mean, I'm bringing my expertise of Year 7 accelerated science to the table and I'm ready to party.
look, let me talk about the motorbikes and, you know, the motocross people.
Yes, motocross people.
Mate, do you know that by the time they're up and running and fully professional, they've broken 1/6 of the bones in their body?
Wow.
So that's about 37 bones out of 216.
I imagine it's collarbones, shoulders.
Are the most frequently broken bone in a
body. Nose? No, they got the helmet on.
Oh, and legs and stuff. And there's two Robbies, Robbie Adelberg, Robbie Morrison, and they're sort of like the evil Knievel. I think it's Middleton. Okay, here's a question for you without notice. You ready for it?
Oh, God, here we go. Yep.
At what age did the two Robbies start riding motorbikes?
Give me 6 years old.
Three.
Ah. Oh!
Mate, can you imagine? So they're 3 years old. They can't speak words properly, right? They do. They're taught to train and everything. They're riding around on motorbikes, and on their little properties, you know, with their parents, and they still believe in Santa and the Tooth Fairy.
That's so fun.
Oh my God, isn't it a weird thing? And then when Robbie Middleton wanted to learn how to do a backflip, he went to the University of Sydney and spoke to a physicist, and she took him through it. And on average, to be able to do a backflip from when you decide is 2 years.
2 years?
2 years of training.
How long did it take him?
I think it was 2 years.
Jesus.
He was a guy who actually jumped the Arc de Triomphe.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, exactly.
And I love how the parents are still okay with, like, he's broken so many bones, but he just loves it.
Yeah.
And I think that's beautiful.
they're different from you and me. They don't have fear in the way that you and I have. And also, they seem to heal from their broken bones a lot better. And when they're doing that, when they're doing a backflip, that's 3/4 of a turn, or a forward flip, that's 1 1/4 turns. There's only three people in the world who can do a forward flip. And they've got a phrase where they want to land RSD, which stands for rubber side down.
RSD.
RSD. And during their flight from takeoff to landing, over 3 seconds, they'll have their hands on the handlebars and then shift their body around so it's at right angles to the bike in a straight line. And then they'll grab the actual handles, the seat, and then occasionally they'll let go of the bike entirely. And right, during that 3 second window, there are these two lumps of matter, a human and a motorbike, traveling through the air, and they have to join up to it. And they do this complicated thing with tucking in and moving out to change their rate of spin so they land RSD. But also during the actual 3 second flight, they might flick the accelerator on and you'll see the occasional one and occasional two puffs of smoke, all of this in 3 seconds. OMG.
Oh my goodness. Well, that's one reason that I'm never going to be a professional motorbiker, but we have some callers on the line.
Hurrah.
With their questions. Coco in the gong, what's your question?
Hey, doctors. I was just wondering, how do one-way mirrors work?
They're not strictly one way, but they work on having one side light and one side dark. And you can see this in the daytime when you're in an office building, and even though you've got lights on inside the office building, it's much brighter outside. And so unless it's really bright inside, basically the glass just reflects you. But then at nighttime, when it's really dark outside and the lights on the inside are just as bright, you can see in, but they can't. So it's simply having a difference in lighting. There is no such thing as a genuine one-way mirror. What you have is glass that's heavily tinted, and you have people on the other side in a room that's perfectly dark with no light in it.
Oh, so if you want to check if you're being spied on, it's more about knowing the lights than it is looking at the particular features of the glass?
No, that is correct. There are various physical reasons why you can't have a one-way mirror, which I've kind of forgotten, and I wrote a story about this, but Coco, forgive me, I've totally forgotten what it was. Oh my God. There is a reason why you can't have glass that lets light through only in one direction, and I'll try and look it up in the break.
Well, Coco, I hope that helps you in case there is a suspected one-way mirror in your life.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Coco. And we've got Kenton from Canberra on the line. Kenton, what's your question?
Good morning, doctors. I'm just wondering, are humans the only animals that sneeze through their mouth? I've seen pets and stuff sneeze through their nose. I've tried to sneeze through my nose and I can't do it. I can hold back a sneeze, but I just can't seem to sneeze through my nose.
Whoa. This is an ENT or ear, nose and throat question. And I have a bit of knowledge that I think is correct, but I can't exactly answer the question. We'd need a vet, either a small or a large animal vet, to ring in. And the number they should ring in is 0439757555.
Very good, Dr.
Thank
Carl.
You. Thank you. I've been training. But what I know is this, is that apparently we humans are the only animal that can choke to death that in with food, because we have a crossover. So you've got a mouth that food comes through, but also air comes through, and then you've got to have a little flap valve. And you want the air to go to the lungs and you want the food to go into the esophagus and then continue on for 10 metres in us or 1 metre of a gut in a dog. And we've shifted our larynx down so that we can have very fine control of our speech. And in fact, to get clear speech usually takes till the age of 9 or 10, where you can say things like British Constitution and not slur your words. And so the cost of us being able to speak is that because our larynx has shifted, we can then choke to death. The sneezing thing, I think I've sneezed through my nose.
I was going to say it, Kenton. I don't want to be rude, but I have sneezed through my nose before. I have done it. So Kenton, just you cannot sneeze through your nose, to be clear.
I try, because I assume that a sneeze is to get rid of something out of your nose. So I'm trying to sneeze out my nose. And I just can't do it. I either hold it back or go a big R2.
Well, to be disgusting, I actually let it go on one occasion and put a tissue in front to see what happened, and all this crud came out. Did you find that, Sam?
Yes, I do. I have bad sinuses, so I often want to get sneeze out the nose because it clears everything out.
Well,
it goes really fast.
I don't think you should assign low moral values to your sinuses, but rather blame evolution or God, because a sinus is defined as a chamber that's only got one entry and exit, only one. Now, when we were on all fours, the drain point would be at the lowest point. But now that we're standing up, the drain point is not at the lowest point.
Yeah.
Bad design. It's like some of the older MG sports cars where the drain point in the boot, because water gets into the boot, was about 10 centimetres above the lowest point of the boot, so that you'd have a little swimming pool in the back of your MG.
Well isn't that nice? Also, correction on the text line, Dr. Carl, it's Robbie Madison.
Madison.
We're having a great time.
He is amazing. The way that they can do all of that physics in their mind, but it's not just a physics, it's the fear and also spatial awareness. If I were to go upside down, I would lose my orientation. They keep it exactly. They know exactly.
Yeah, they just have such a great sense of balance and moving. Science with Dr. Carl. Dr. Carl is in the building. He's wearing a lovely shirt with, orcas?
Some sort of soft, blobby sea creature. Large. I'm thinking a
dugong?
Manatee.
Yeah, manatee dugong, but like a lovely dugong? White colour. It kind of looks like very vaguely sheep-like. It's very beautiful.
The sheep of the sea, yeah.
Bit of theatre of the mind there for you. We've got some amazing, some follow-ups from our last chat. We have experts on the line. First of all, we had a question earlier about animal sneezing. We've got Sarah from Melbourne on the line who said, I'm a vet. Talk to me. Sarah, hello.
Dr. Sarah, hi. Welcome and thank you for ringing in. We love you.
Hi, doctors. Thanks for having me on.
So lay it on us about sneezing. And was I right with my memory about we humans are virtually the only animal that can choke to death on their food?
Well, I'm not sure about most animals, but definitely we can see that problem in dogs.
Dogs can do it.
Flat-faced dogs in particular, so your brachycephalics, French bulldogs, and the like.
Okay, so they've been bred over the last couple of hundred years, but you, what about your average wild dog? Could they choke to death?
Average wild dog, not so sure about that, but it is certainly something we see quite often in our flat-faced pets.
Oh, my goodness. Sarah, thank you so much for having that on the line. I mean, do you come
can
across...
Can they sneeze?
Can they sneeze, though?
They can. Dogs tend to do what we call reverse sneezing, so it sounds more like a gasp inwards, but it functions the same sort of way as our sneezes do.
Yeah, I do know my dogs, when they sneeze, make the most hysterical noises.
It's like that'll be it.
Woof! It is a reverse gasp. That's the best way to describe it.
So dogs can sneeze.
Dogs can
sneeze.
Sure
can. Absolutely. But
tell me more about this reverse sneeze.
It's basically just functions the same way as human sneezing, just sort of inwards rather than outwards. It sounds different, but it's still a way of sort of clearing debris from the nasal passages.
Oh, so we sneeze to clear debris from the airways and the lungs. Is that what we... Mm.
As far as I know about sneezing, it's usually when you've got something that's irritating the nose, so the body's sort of trying to expel debris that way, and dogs just do it a little bit differently.
Ah, so that's because they don't have neat little thumbs or little fingers where they can pick their nose.
Theoretically, I guess.
So why do they do it inwards, though?
That I'm not sure on. You'd have to talk to an anatomist about that.
Oh, of course. There's so many branches of knowledge. You just get deeper.
Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sarah.
And we've got another follow-up. Cam from Victoria, who said, I am close mates with Robbie Oldenburg and Robbie Madison. I've ridden dirt bikes, competed with them for over 20 years. I've broken lots of bones. Cam, hello. Tell us about your broken bones.
Hey guys, stoked to talk to you. Yes, I've been riding dirt bikes pretty much my whole life since I was 4 years old as well. And I've broken a lot of bones in my career.
Dr. Carl, you said that there's a crazy stat about how many bones they break before they're early.
From memory, there's 216 bones in the body, and they said in a little research that the professional riders, by the time they get good in their careers, have broken some 37 bones.
Now, Cam, does that align with your experience?
Pretty much does, yes. But it wasn't so much just broken bones. I had a lot of head injuries, and I was comatized, and I've had probably about 10 concussions, and I've had all sorts of different injuries, just as much as broken bones.
But they still love dirt bikes. Do you get out and do it a little less risky, just a little poodle around on the trails?
Actually, I'm still riding almost semi-professional, so
I
still enjoy it.
Semi-professional? Yeah. That is a very... I am so impressed by the skill and how they have to do so many things in such a short period of time.
Yeah. Cam... stay safe out there, and we thank you for, I guess, proving Dr. Carl's statistics correct about how many broken bones there are.
No worries, guys. I appreciate it, and I'm stoked to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Cam. We've also got Pixie from Ballarat on the line. Pixie, you have a question about the distance from the Earth to the Sun.
I do. Hello. I was wondering, I mean, I know we can measure the distance between the Earth and the Sun, but I was wondering if it has been done by researchers over time to measure if there was a different distance, like over history. So like say 400 million years ago, was it still the same distance or was it different? Is that something that people have been able to figure out?
Oh, yes. So the Earth is drifting away from the Sun a little bit every year, 1.5 centimetres, roughly the size of a little joint in the end of your finger. And that's because the Sun is losing mass by converting mass into energy, E equals MC squared, and also the solar wind. So it's got less gravity. So the Earth is moving out by 1.5 centimetres a year. And you mentioned 400 million years. That's about 6,000 kilometres, which is not enough to affect the weather. We do know that the Earth changes its orbit in three different ways. It's called the Milankovitch cycle. Look it up on Wikipedia, Milankovitch. And on a 100,000-year cycle, the Earth changes its orbit from sort of more circular to more egg-shaped or elliptical and then back again. And then on a 41 or 42,000-year cycle, the angle of tilt of the Earth varies between 21.5 and 24.5 degrees. At the moment, it's 23.5 from the vertical and heading down. And then on a 24,000-year cycle, the whole tilt of the Earth slowly sweeps out a circle like a slowly spinning top, and these help bring in the ice ages. But then if you go way back in time, you realise that in all of the solar systems that we've looked at, that Earth is very uncommon. We've looked at about 5,000 solar systems, and the most common things are either you've got a hot Jupiter, in other words, something the size of Jupiter, which is close to the Sun, or you've got a bunch of super-Earths, and they're like five times the mass of the Earth. And what we're thinking happened in our solar system was that we had super-Earths, and then Jupiter, via various physics, drifted in towards the Sun and started the inner planets running into each other, and then if it had stayed there, they would have then gone in all different directions and dissipated. But it towed Saturn in behind it, and then fancy more physics, then that Saturn then dragged it out. It's called the Big Tack, T-A-C-K theory, as in tacking on a boat to go upwind. And so Jupiter went out back to where it was, and then all of the rubble turned into the four inner rocky planets. So, but we've been here probably for about 4.5 billion years. Roughly the same distance, although that would have changed when something the size of Mars slammed into the Earth about 100 million years after it formed. Big topic there that you've hit us with.
Yeah, Pixie, there's a lot of information. Did that answer at least some of your questions or give you some areas to jump off to?
That's given me a heap of Wikipedia rabbit holes. Thank you.
And just one thing, we're fairly confident via what the scientists call proxies, because we have to look at other things to measure where the Earth was, that about 400 million years ago, the Earth was where it was, but the continents were in completely different shapes.
Yeah.
They've rearranged themselves, so sometimes they've been running north-south from the North Pole to the South Pole, and other times they've been mostly running horizontally in the Southern Hemisphere.
Thanks so much, Dr. Pixie. Bring back Pangea, I say. And we've got so many texts in. I think Cam was selling himself short, Dr. Carl, who we had on just before. Former professional racer, motocrosser, landed the first double backflip in a freestyle motocross run at the third event of the Red Bull X Fighters World Tour 2009 in Fort Worth, Texas.
Hang on.
He was underselling himself.
That's wonderful humility. And for me, the weird thing, we're doing this for our TV series coming up early next year, How Things Work. But the amazing thing being backstage was how all of the motorbike riders were so collegiate and friendly and helpful to each other. And they had families there. And it was none of this sort of, for me to succeed, you must fail. It was like they all go together. So let me get it straight. He did the world's first double backflip.
The first double backflip in a freestyle motocross run. So like, I think less kind of staged specifically to get that backflip. Like it was in the middle of like a otherwise
double
run.
Double backflip.
It's pretty impressive. And we also got more texts in, people, a lot of dirt bikers texting in saying they've broken about the amount of bones that you said.
37?
Yeah, well, 25 from 25. Someone.
Well, now, who was it? Robbie Middleton?
Madison.
When he did, do you know he jumped the Arc de Triomphe? When he came off, he tore his thumb off.
Jesus Christ.
But he kept on going as a professional.
They keep on going.
Oh, my God.
Here on Triple J, it's Science with Dr. Carl. It's Mornings with Sam Lane. I'm filling in for Lucy today. I get to do some science. Dr. Carl, we have an absolute banger question right here from Tom in Brisbane. Dr. Tom, what's your question?
Howdy, doctors.
Dr. Tom, welcome.
Welcome, guys. So basically, during most of the wars, most of the countries gave illicit substances to their soldiers so they could march through the night and be full of confidence and keep their moods up. Most of them were amphetamines. What was the best amphetamine that was used throughout those wars?
It's hard to say best or efficient.
What's the best amphetamine? Where
you're looking at a goal, which is to kill other people and or to stop other people from killing you. So it gets messy. All wars are messy. So amphetamines, benzodrine, et cetera, were used by the Germans and the Nazis and the UK and the US and Japan and everybody during World War II. And the good thing was that they weren't tired and they could have increased alertness and they were very confident, but their decision-making was bad and it could lead to cases of addiction. And after they came down, they really crashed badly and they were useless for a while. And so if you needed them to fight as a soldier, they couldn't do during their recovery time. Methamphetamine, big for Nazi Germany, millions of tablets, more potent than amphetamine, and they could stay awake literally for days, but severe addiction, hallucinations, cardiovascular effects, and some of them end up going off their face. Cocaine, beloved by the music industry, and there was something about a Fleetwood Mac album where they did a whole album on cocaine and then brought it to the producers and said, this sounds like crap. And the thing about cocaine is it destroys your sense of judgment. So you're doing stuff, and you say, oh, this is fantastic music I'm playing and composing. It's crap. But it has that short addiction, short duration, and impairs your judgment again. And every now and then if you see a famous muso dying at a very early age, you kind of think, you know, maybe cocaine can be there. And that was limited in use. Caffeine, every military takes it. All drugs are poisons. What matters is the dose. They all have side effects. And you've got to balance the timing. So is it okay for them to work for a couple of days flat out and then just crash? And you know for sure that the enemy won't mount a re-attack in 2 days' time. Is that kind of answering what you're thinking about, Tom, or is there something else you're asking about as well?
Yeah, it definitely do it. I think I also kind of thought, does that mean if you were an athlete and you were to take it, would you be able to ride a bike a further distance as well? Like, would it improve, obviously, your ability for obviously a short period of time, maybe 2 or 3 days, but would you get a better result if they were to take, if you put a top athlete in that process as well?
So, I mean, Dr. Sam is actually going to jump in here, shockingly. Rare jump in. If you watch old Tour de France footage, they're on crazy cocktails of drugs because it was like around the same time as World War II when it was like these drugs weren't seen as illicit. They were like more over the counter or whatever. And so you watch some of those older athletes and they are absolutely shaken on gallons of meth going through the French countryside. And hey, they made them complete the Tour de France, but at what cost? Because if you watch the old, Dr. Carl, have you seen the videos of like Hitler at the end of the war and he's just shaking in his chair because he's been taking meth for months? There's some insane videos you can see.
So tell me about that again.
So if you look up, there's some, I'm a bit of a history buff, so I've looked this up. He has, there's videos of him later on in the war when he's sitting at like a Nazi rally or something, and he literally is unable to sit still. He's shaking because he was taking so many drugs, so much amphetamines that he was just like, he looks seriously unwell, and historians attribute that to the immense amount of meth he was taking.
Now, wasn't there something recently called the Enhanced Games?
Yes, there was.
And weren't they allowed to take any drugs they wanted, and they didn't break any records?
No, one record was broken, but it was in the swimming, and that was more to do with the suits they were using. They were wearing the ones that they wore in Beijing in 2008 when they were like the illegal
low-body suits.
Yeah, and those were all the records. But none of the athletes, like the track athletes, broke records. Tom, we've gone a little bit off topic, but I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, it does.
Thank you, Dr. Tom.
Thank you, Dr. Tom. And we got Zara from Dr. Zara in Melbourne on the line. Hello, Dr. Zara.
Hi, guys.
Hello. What's your question, Dr. Zara?
My question is, why does going 100 kilometres an hour at night feel faster than going 100K during the day?
That is a real effect, and it's related to how your brain works out your speed by what's coming in. And what's coming into your eyes is different. So firstly, you don't have a full 180 field of view. You've just got this narrow cone ahead of you where everything outside is dark, so you've got less information to judge on. So if something's coming past you at the side, you go, oh, that went past. But you getting closer to a sign 400 metres away directly in your line of view, that happens more slowly. Secondly, the contrast is higher. You've got this bright tunnel of light. If you're lucky enough to be driving a car with LED lights, if you've got the old-fashioned incandescents, it's kind of like a yellow Chinese paper lantern, but the modern lights are terrific. And our system is sensitive to high-contrast changes, which exaggerate the sense of speed. The other thing is that objects just appear suddenly. Whereas in the daytime, you can see, oh, there's this huge tree, and then off to the side of the road. And then as you get closer to it, suddenly it just pops into view. But then also, you've got reduced depth perception because you judge your depth from the colour and the texture and the shadows and your memory, and you've got less of that information coming through. So I guess also your brain's working a little bit harder because you haven't got it. So all of those things put together mean that you judge things to be travelling faster. Also, if you're close to the ground, you judge things to be faster. So we've had many cases of SUVs tipping over, and it's because they're higher off the ground, and so they estimate that they're travelling more slowly, and so then there's more single-person accidents where they just tip over.
Does that answer your question, Dr. Zara?
Yeah, any follow-up? Thank you so much. No, that covers everything.
We did it, Dr. Carl. And we've got Dr. Grant from Wagga on the line. Dr. Grant, what's your question?
Morning, guys. So my question is, why is red meat red and white meat white when both animals have red blood?
Ah, okay. So globin. So in your blood, you've got hemoglobin, and it's four globular chemicals joined together to make one big chemical, and each of them has got an atom of iron, and it can hang on to oxygen. But the job of the hemoglobin is to deliver oxygen to your tissues, and we're going to talk muscles. And there you have it being picked up by another chemical called myoglobin, and it contains iron. And here's your answer. The more myoglobin, the redder the meat. And so if you've got an animal which doesn't do a lot of work, like a chicken or a turkey can't fly, well, then it doesn't have a lot of myoglobin. But if you've got an animal that's walking around a lot, standing and walking, like beef or venison or lamb, then they've got more myoglobin. So with the white meat, not much myoglobin. Red meat, more myoglobin. Is that kind of helping?
Yeah, I think so. I'll have to go and look up those terms and research it a little bit more now.
Thank you. And then next time you get a chicken, look at it carefully. And so the muscles that the chicken uses, or that a bird uses to fly, are the breast muscles. And so you have to look at people like Arnold Schwarzenegger and bodybuilders to see a reasonable sort of hunk of pectoralis major that is not enough to fly. Instead of maybe, say, 3 or 4 centimetres of pectoralis major, think about 20 centimetres. And what they do is they have a spur coming out of the middle of their chest and a muscle joins onto that. But chickens don't have that, so their breast meat is white, but they do have legs and they walk around on legs. And if you look carefully, their thighs are a little bit darker.
Grant, next time you're buying a chicken, now you know what to do.
And ring in and tell us what you find.
Yes, ring in and tell us about the chicken dinner you make, Dr. Grant.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Dr. Carl.
I'm thrilled to be here. Lay it on us, man.
All right, Isaac in the gong. Dr. Isaac, what's your question?
Hey, doctors.
Hello, Dr. Isaac. What's your question?
You're live to air. Lay it on us, man.
I'm just at work, and me and the boys are talking. We're wondering why sometimes when you look at the sun, you need to sneeze.
This happens to between 1 and 5% of the population. And at the very soft end, it's that you could feel the sneeze building up, and, oh, my God, it's just been building up for ages and you're sick of it. What the heck? You go and stare at the sun for a few seconds and you sneeze. And at the other extreme, and this is very uncommon, you go from a poorly lit room to a brightly lit room and you sneeze, and in your case, it's always the same number of sneezes, 2 or 3 or 5. And if you happen to be driving at sunset, you know, or in the late afternoon, and there's a bunch of trees at the side of the road, each time you go into that shadow and come out of it, you sneeze and you lose vision for a little while. And they first noticed this during the Second World War, when pilots would come out of cloud, fighter pilots, into the sunlight above the cloud and start sneezing and lose their vision for a bit. It was followed up by some, I think, Indian or Pakistani brothers in the 1960s at Harvard who realized that they both had it, and they went to a lot of trouble to call it the Achoo syndrome. A stands for autosomal dominant, meaning they're just stuffing in the letter A there. Chromosomally mediated means that it's via genetics, they're just stuffing in the C using a PX, ACH. H stands for helio, a Greek word or Latin word for the sun. O for ophthalmic, means you look at the sun with your eyes. And the last O stands for outburst, so you sneeze when you look at the sun.
That's a reverse engineered acronym, I would say.
I think we should, that'd be a good name for a band, the reverse engineered acronyms.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Okay, so we think it's because of some crossed wiring in your face, where the sneeze reflex, which is a very powerful reflex, and you want to have it rather than not, is accidentally kissing the information from your eyes, and it sets off the reflex. I haven't found a paper where they've actually followed this up with an MRI scan in the brain, but it might have been done recently. So is that kind of helping a little bit? Isaac, and does it happen to you, this sneezy sun thing?
It doesn't happen to me specifically, but one of the boys that I'm working with today.
And what sort of tradie are you, Isaac?
We're joiners, kitchens, we do.
Oh, mate, I do love the skill that we humans have when we put things together and we make things. So you're actually still making stuff. Oh, my God, I love it. Thank you so much, Dr. Isaac, for actually manufacturing stuff and putting things together properly.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Isaac. Going up to Sydney now, Gemma in Sydney has, I think this is a question of public interest. It's about trying to help out a friend. Dr. Gemma, tell us what's happening.
Hello, Dr. Carl. I found out after years that one of my best friends doesn't think that gravity is real and she doesn't believe that the earth is flat. And I know that they're kind of entwined, but I found out like a few months apart. And I've tried to explain to her why I think it's so important and how it makes sense. And she said, no, I believed it all my life and this is what I've made my decision. And I don't know how to get across to her.
Maybe your friend is using the word gravity in a different way from the rest of us. Like, I'm sure they're aware that if they have a cup or a pen and they drop it, that it goes in a certain direction and that direction is always down. So why does your friend think that happens?
Well, I remember the first time she said that. I remember I dropped something to be like, what do you mean? Like, just to prove it. And I remember her saying, no, it doesn't make sense. And then she started talking about water not being able to bend. And then we got into chemistry and talking about that's how water molecules bond. They bond by bending. Like, that's just how it works. And I feel like I've tried everything and it just doesn't make sense. They think that there's an ice wall around the world and that
they're just trying to make
us think like this. Yeah.
Oh, I actually was having Milan Chinese restaurant not far from the ABC here in Sydney, outdoors, and this guy came up and started telling me that the earth was flat, and then he said there's this ice wall around the world because the earth is flat, and NASA has ships under sea in the ocean floor and in the ocean and ships on the surface and airplanes to stop you going to Antarctica. And I said, but I've been to Antarctica 7 times. And she said, and the guy said, oh, my God, I really thought you hadn't been bought out, but you've been bought out, man. I don't respect you anymore. So the first thing you can do with regard to the earth being round is to get some binoculars. Do you have any binoculars?
No, but I'm willing to buy some. This is a pretty big deal.
Okay, so if you go near the water and you look at a ship heading out of a capital city, you'll gradually see as it sails away and looking through the binoculars, the hull disappears first. And we're looking at a distance maybe 10 kilometres away, and then the decks, and then finally the mast. And so it's going around the curve of the earth.
Yeah.
Whereas if the earth was flat, it'd just simply get smaller but remain fully visible, assuming you've got a powerful binoculars. Right?
Well, it's worth it.
Okay. And then with regard to, have you seen a lunar eclipse, the one that happens at night?
Yes. Are you going to talk about the holes in the ground and the stick and the shadow?
I haven't got there yet, but we're just talking about the lunar eclipse. Yeah. So whenever the lunar eclipse happens, when the sun and the earth and the moon are in a straight line, they're in a straight line, and then the moon is covered by the earth from the sun, so the earth comes exactly between the sun and the moon, and as it comes across, it puts a shadow on the moon. Now you're saying, oh yeah, but that's okay, the earth could be a round disc, but if you watch it over the years, always it's a round shadow. It's not an elliptical or egg-shaped shadow, and the only way you can have that is if the Earth is a sphere. And then secondly, I'll give you a little tiny thing about gravity, which you might want to play back to your friend. So Isaac Newton came up with the theory of gravity, and it was pretty good, F equals G M1M2 on the distance squared. And it worked for everything in the solar system, as the astronomers got their telescopes better, except for Mercury. And Mercury, it didn't obey that law. And it took Einstein in 1915 to explore it, to explain it. And here's the summary. Gravity is curved space. Okay, that's the first sentence. Here comes the second sentence, which is a bit longer. Mass tells space how to bend, comma, and curved space tells matter where to go. And now I'm going to explain that. So imagine that space is a flat trampoline sheet, and you've got a little golf ball, which will turn into a comet in a little while, and you flick this golf ball in flat space where there's no matter around, there's just empty space, and you flick the golf ball with your fingernail and it goes in a straight line. And then you add in a mass, the sun, and in this case you've got a big heavy bowling ball, and you put it in the middle of the trampoline and it curves down. So you got the image so far, Gemma?
Yeah.
Now you flick the golf ball with your fingernail and it'll go on a curved path, either slightly curved or a lot curved, or even fall into the bowling ball. So mass, that's the sun or the bowling ball, it curves space. And then objects that have mass, they follow that curved space. I don't know what else to say.
No, that's perfect. That's more than plenty for what I've tried, and I'm willing to try anything. So that's great. And the binoculars are not much cheaper option. I was told to maybe try to fly to Europe so that they could see out the airplane window that's like the curve. But binoculars sound a lot cheaper.
Yeah. The other thing is, how come there's different time zones around the world if all the Earth is just laid flat and there's just one sun floating in the middle above us? And by the way, has your friend gone into the barrier syndrome, where there's this barrier 400 kilometres up that God put there?
They don't believe in God. They think that that's a load of la-la.
Okay.
So these things aren't matching up, are they?
Okay, look, look, best of luck, but they can still be your friend. And by the way, you know the story with the Styx and Eratosthenes and 2,000 years ago, measuring the circumference of the Earth accurate to within 10%, just with some Styx and shadows, and people called Bemeters, B-E-M-E-T-A-R-S, who are people who are not just surveyors, but surveyors who, back in those days, were trained to walk with a constant step length.
Ah.
And so you say, I want you to walk in that direction and tell me how many steps you take when you go from Damascus to Baghdad. And so there were people who were trained in that, and they used that to work out the circumference of the Earth. Best of luck, and let us know how you go, could you, next week, in a couple of weeks' time?
I'd love to. Thank you so much.
And by the way, if you go chasing, it's John Wheeler made up that sentence. Mass tells space how to curve, and then curve space tells mass where to go. So look up John Wheeler, W-H-W-E-L-E-R, for explanations on that, and maybe you'll find more that can help your friend.
That's awesome. Thanks so much, Dr. Carl.
Thank you, Dr. Jenna. And we've got Callum in the gong rounding us nearly out for today. Dr. Callum, back in the gong. What's your question?
So, hey, Dr. Carl. My question is, if a drone was to fly in a moving car, would the drone remain stationary in place, or would it drift to the back of the car?
If you set upright, it would travel at the speed of the car, which is anything between 30 and, if you're crazy, 200 kilometres an hour. So velocity is relative to something. So you go into an aeroplane and it begins to take off and you're thinking, oh, my God, I'm really being pushed back in my seat. So you are accelerating. And then at around 200, 300 kilometres an hour, you lift off, and then going uphill, you accelerate again. Oh, man, those engines are so powerful. And finally, you're up there doing 800, 900 kilometres an hour. And then if you go into the aisle and then drop your pen, or if you just jump into the air a little bit, you go into the aisle of the plane and you start heading down the back of the plane, but instead you just stop and you jump into the air, you do not fly through the body of the aeroplane at 900 kilometres an hour and end up as a thin layer of chunky red salsa over the inside of the back of the plane. You just land exactly where you took off from. So in the case of the drone, If it's sitting on the ground or sitting on your lap in the car, it'll get pushed backward during acceleration. And then when you start hovering, it'll hover with the car whether it's doing 20 or 100 kilometres an hour. But if you have it hovering in the car and then you take off, it'll end up against the rear window. And you can do this experiment. Now, Calum, do you ever go to kids' parties where they have helium balloons?
Yes.
Okay, here's a fun experiment to do. Get a helium balloon and tie it to something so it's just floating in the middle of the car. And when you go around a corner and everybody gets thrown to one side, the helium balloon gets thrown to the other side. And when you brake hard and everybody gets thrown forward, the helium balloon goes back. Because the air is going one way and the helium being lighter than the air goes the other way. So do that as a fun experiment for your family.
Thank you, Dr. Calum. I think that's all we have time for, everyone, but it's been fantastic. Dr. Carl, a pleasure as always. You'll be back next week with Dr. Lucy, I take it?
Yeah, but this is opposite to the motorbikes. So in the motorbikes, their 3-second flight through the air to them, they all told me, feels like 6 seconds, whereas our little talk here just seemed like to go for a minute.
It flew by. Time flies when you're having fun. Thanks so much for listening. Lucy will be back next week. And Dr. Carl, you can get this wherever you get your podcast. Thank you to Ella Carter for producing this episode.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.